This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by Go Engineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit theuavdigest.com/goengineer. And by UAV Propulsion Tech, a provider of propulsion, servo, autopilots, and rescue and recovery parachute solutions for the unmanned aerial vehicle market. For more information, check out www.uavpropulsiontech.com. You're listening to episode 115 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm in David Vanderhoof. I'm Philadelphia in David Vanderhoof. Oh, it's going to be one of those nights.
Oh, dear. Well, at least we're back home this time, David.
Yeah, we are. We're back home, and I don't know about you, but we're now preparing for, I know I'm not supposed to talk about the weather, but we're in Nor'easter Watch and Hurricane Watch here on the East Coast of as we record this. So not looking forward to the weather over the next couple of days.
Yeah, it's going to get messy, but why don't we get started?
We should. We got some news. Drones with lasers. How very Star Wars-ish. NASA Wallops looks to improve their facilities for drones. The FAA is not hoping that what you want for Christmas is a drone. And AUVSI and other 28 organizations started to complain about the FAA, but let's talk about some happy news first. We had a good time last week, didn't we?
Yeah, we attended the UAS Industry Days up in upstate New York. That was jointly put on by the New Air Alliance, the UAS test site in upstate New York, and also the local chapter of AUVSI. Last week, we had some two presentations from that, and we have some more coming up.
We do. These two actually sort of focus on testing, so that's good. But overall, what was your impression of the conference? I thought it was really interesting and sort of rewarding to me because we have a lot of themes that we talk about, and they were reverberated by the experts. So I guess that makes us experts, Max.
Well, at least we're of the same mind on a lot of these issues, I think. It was an interesting group. This was clearly a commercial UAS-focused group, not hobbyists or enthusiasts. These are people that have business plans or look forward to business plans in this industry. So it was great to hear what they're thinking. It was great to meet many of them. We had some fantastic presentations, and you and I conducted some really interesting little interviews on the side, and we're going to be bringing all of that to our audience. So I'm excited about that.
Yeah, and we'd like to thank New Air and AUVSI for giving us the opportunity. But I guess I came away with three big themes, which was, one, we need to educate the public on how to fly safely. The other one was, we need to enforce the regulations we already have. And that means enforcing privacy laws when privacy laws are broken, and not creating specific UAV laws for privacy. So educate, and then innovation, and working with the FAA so those regulations can be enforced. So really wonderful people that we met, generally well-spoken, very interested, very knowledgeable, and a lot of cross-pollination from agriculture to videography. All in all, everyone seems to be, was sort of on the same page up there. I was really pleased with that.
Yeah, and there really is some pent-up interest in making some progress, making commercial progress, and a certain frustration that was evident, frustration with the lack of enforceable regulations from the FAA at this point.
So I guess we should get started with the news. The first one is, let's talk about predators and reapers, and drones armed with high-energy lasers may arrive in 2017. This was from DefenseOne.com. It looks like General Atomics Aeronautics Systems, Inc., is looking to mount a laser on their Predator C. Now, the Predator C is the jet version of the Reaper. It's not a turboprop. It's a jet-powered aircraft. And this is a private initiative, but it should be ready in 2017.
Yeah, it's interesting that it is being funded privately. I think the implications of that may be that General Atomics would then own the IP, the intellectual property associated with what they develop here. I think if it had been a government-funded effort, then the government would have owned that. So that's probably why it's being approached this way by General Atomics. But this is a pretty beefy laser, I guess. This is a 150-kilowatt solid-state laser that they're looking at. But, you know, there are some challenges with that. One of them is just being able to hit the target, mounting that on an aircraft that, you know, maybe moves around a little bit might be challenging. I don't know, Dave, we don't have any, or do we have any laser-mounted aircraft in the military at this point?
Well, we had the AL-1, which was the 747 with the laser mounted in the nose that they eventually scrapped. Hmm. But we do use laser designators all the time for precision-guided bombs. So having a laser on an aircraft to designate a target is one thing. Having it with enough power to put a hole in something or destroy something is completely something different. Now, the last time we tried to put a laser in an airplane, we took a 747 to put a laser to have all the stuff to go with the laser, the generator part, in so that you could generate something that would burn a missile or something. But it's new technology being integrated into new technology. And it's also interesting that they're not dealing with a standard Predator or a Reaper, but they're dealing with the Avenger, which is the jet version.
They may be using that one because, as we understand it, the laser is powered through the aircraft's, through the Predator's, well, the Avenger's power system. In other words, that jet engine apparently powers some other unit, which then powers the laser. And maybe they need the horsepower, if you will, of the jet engine.
And, of course, that answer came from the jet engine manufacturer of the group. So we'll follow up with that. Let's talk some other positive news. And I've tried reaching out to them. I'll follow up with them. But I'd love to get someone from NASA Wallops on. They're looking to bump up drone traffic. And they're working with the state of Virginia to expand the facility at NASA Wallops, which is on the Atlantic coast, on the Delmarva, off of the Delmarva Peninsula.
Yeah, what they're planning to do is build a 3,000-foot runway that would be for use of drones there on Wallops Island. There's some attractive reasons for doing that there. They mentioned that one of them is that environment is more controlled than at most airports. It's sort of isolated. You've got water around it in case of failures and things like that. The idea is that the Virginia Commercial Space Flight Authority would build and operate this runway. NASA owns the land. And they envision that this test range could be used for a variety of users, commercial, government, as well as academic. So it's kind of creating another test site.
NASA's really getting into the drone business, it seems. And the nice thing is they're driving it. They're pushing it forward with the integration of the airspace, et cetera. So it's nice to know that DA in NASA is still active and it's commercial and government coming together to put out a product. Right. Hopefully we'll get somebody from NASA Wallops on because right now they're launching drones into hurricanes from there. So I'd like to follow up on that. So let's talk about the next news story. Christmas is coming, and the FAA is terrified.
Why is that, David?
They're afraid there's going to be at least a million drones sold this holiday season.
Wow.
It's a pretty awesome number of drones. Now, a million drones, that could mean ones that are being bounced around living rooms like yours truly has, up to DJI Phantoms and other quadcopters, etc. And the potential of these people getting involved in stuff that they don't know everything about is a little worrisome to the FAA. And I guess if we talk to people up at the convention, they would say pretty much the same thing, that it's worrisome that this form of aviation is so accessible to the general public. What would you say to that, Max?
Yeah, I mean, even if the number of unsafe flyers, let's say, is very small percentage, when you start talking about big numbers like a million drones being sold, then that's, there's a lot of opportunity for bad things to happen. You know, hopefully that there is an appreciation for the need of retailers and others to try to explain, try to make people aware of what they should be doing, what they shouldn't be doing, how they should be treating these. But with numbers like this, David, I just think that there are going to be so many people that are just going to order them, give them to their kids, and, you know, like many parents today, just walk away and let their kids do whatever it is that their kids are going to do.
Okay, let's talk about something we've been talking about since day one. October 1st, and we're recording this on October 1st, has come and gone, and the FAA was supposed to have a plan to integrate UASs
into the national airspace.
We don't have one. So this was from American Surveyor. AUVSI and 28 other organizations, Mark, missed FAA deadline for UAS integration. There was a letter written about the fact that the FAA has dropped the ball and they were supposed to come up with a national airspace integration system by September 30th, 2015.
As we know, the FAA didn't. So the AUVSI, the Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International, and as David mentioned, 28 others sent this letter to the FAA administrator. A couple of quotes from the letter. They say, while the FAA has hit some milestones in the integration process, it is yet to finalize small UAS rules, let alone facilitate the full integration of UAS that Congress contemplated in 2012. It says the increasing number of businesses applying for Section 333 exemptions demonstrates the pent-up demand for commercial UAS operations and the immediate need for a regulatory framework.
In the absence of regulations, American businesses and innovators are left sitting on the sidelines or operating under a restrictive exemption process.
Yeah.
And last but not least, on behalf of the businesses across a wide range of industrial sectors in the United States, we urge the FAA to use all available means to finalize the small UAS rules immediately without any further delays and to move ahead with the next regulatory steps on the path for integrating all UAS into the NAS. Once this happens, we will have established a framework for UAS operations that will do away with the case-by-case system of approvals, reducing the barriers to commercial operations, and importantly, having more trained commercial operators will create a culture of safety that helps deter the careless and reckless behavior. It's a letter, folks. The FAA ain't going to move any quicker because of this letter signed by 28 organizations plus AUVSI. Unfortunately, it's just I'm getting up pent-up frustrations, but we're still going to have to wait. I mean, unless Congress does something. And one of the comments that came up at our conference was the fact that the FAA is due for renewal in the next month, and we're talking about government shutdowns and the FAA reauthorization, and all of that's going to come into play. And so I wouldn't expect a ruling anytime soon, at least not the next couple of months.
No, I think that the process is working. I think the AUVSI and these organizations, industry as a whole, needed to kind of go on record saying that, yeah, you did miss the deadline, and yes, we are dissatisfied, and we really want that to change. I mean, I think it's good for that to be on the record, as it were. But I agree with you, David. The letter itself is not going to get, I don't think, cause the FAA to move faster. They're executing a process to get to that end point of having regulations. It'll be interesting to see if the Congress, in the hopefully soon to come reauthorization bill for the FAA, gives them any additional motivation or emphasis to get this done, or deadlines or guidance or something. I mean, that's possible.
For all of you at home or listening in your headphones saying, well, what can I do? The first thing we need to do is you need to contact your congressman or your senator and tell them how important it is to you for the FAA reauthorization bill. If the FAA doesn't get reauthorized, we're really up a creek without a paddle. So reach out to your senators and reach out to your congressman and say that you want them to support the FAA reauthorization bill, and it's really important. And the reason why is because you want UAS regulations. And reach out and be a little proactive and tell these people it's important. We don't really want it to shut down. And if it shuts down, we don't get our UAS regulations. So something to think about.
And if you're not a U.S. citizen, well, then you can just sit back and chuckle a little and watch the show.
For all of our overseas listeners, we're sorry.
It's the way we do things.
But we've heard other countries like Australia where they have equally tough regulations and slow churning bureaucracies. I think every country is familiar with their own bureaucracy. It's not just the United States.
Well, David, you want to do a couple of interviews from the conference?
Sure. One of the things that we went to the new air hangar at Griffiths International Airport, which was formerly Griffiths Air Force Base. The hangar actually was a former B-52 nose dock. For people who don't know what a nose dock is, it's a hangar that's big enough to hold from the just slightly behind the wing to the tip of the nose. The rest of the aircraft hangs out the back. But it's a very sizable hangar. And the first night we were there, they actually had the Aurora Flight Services Centaur, which is a modified Diamond DA-42. And the first interview will be Thomas Washington, who was the manager of flight test operations for Aurora. So he'll talk about flying the Centaur unmanned at Griffiths. And the next one will be John Reed from Quanterion, I think it was.
Yep, Quanterion.
And he works with the Air Force Research Laboratory, or the AFRL. And they had two Desert Hawk UAVs that they tested at Griffiths also. With that, I think let's take it away.
So I was getting ready to talk to some representatives from a major aerospace company. And David came around and said, you know, Aurora Flight Sciences is here. And he drugged me away to talk to Thomas Washington. Hi, thanks for talking to the UAV Digest.
No problem.
Well, the reason why is we're in a hangar full of small aircraft, and then there's this one large full-size Diamond aircraft that has a video running in front of it where you get to watch it taxi and fly sans people. Thomas, you want to tell us about what we're standing next to?
Sure. It's a, like I said, it's the baseline airplane of the Centaur is a Diamond Twin Star, or DA-42, that we've essentially converted to be a what we call an optionally piloted airplane. So what that means is, sure, you can fly it as a normal light twin, or you can fly it as a unmanned airplane, and there's actually a third mode of operation where it's called the hybrid mode, where you can actually fly what we call an onboard safety pilot who has, you know, control, the ability to be able to take over and, you know, resume control of the airplane. But it can also be essentially controlled from a ground control station as well. So that's what this airplane that we have here is, and it's the same one that's actually in the video that you saw. We came up here, I guess, to Griffiths earlier this summer to do a what we called our unmanned flight test campaign, where we essentially, like I said, took the pilot out of the airplane and flew a couple of sorties locally as an unmanned airplane.
Did you have to do many manned flights before going unmanned in order to check out the systems and so forth?
Yeah, so I guess the process that we went through for development of this asset started several years ago. I guess the program originally started back in 2009, where we had the idea of this whole UAS that was what we call self-deployable. So the concept was, you know, instead of packing your, taking apart your UAV, your large UAV, and putting it in a packing shipping containers and shipping it wherever you wanted to go fly, well, why not fly in with the airplane, do some sort of minimal amount of conversion, and then, you know, be able to operate as an unmanned airplane. So that was the original concept. And yes, it was from a development to what you see right now has been a, I guess, a process where we started off with, you know, doing smaller, simple things like just being able to develop the avionics and the mechanical bits and the software associated with just the basic thing of, you know, flying the airplane upright, you know, up and away. Then we moved on to things like takeoff and landing, and we moved into things like, you know, handling emergencies and failures of the system. So it's been a long kind of process, but that, you know, it's worked out.
How much of it is stock? What are we putting in to make it an optionally manned aircraft?
So what we do, I mean, like I said, the airplane is obviously stock. What we do is we take, we use some of the provisions that are available, some of the spaces such as, you know, baggage compartments and things like that, to add avionics that we need to do, you know, sense of, you know, air data and attitude, and to provide places to put the necessary, you know, computing and similarly, we also remove the, from an actuation standpoint, we remove the, instead of cutting holes in the airplane and putting, you know, servos and actuators in the actual wings and tail, we actually remove the co-pilot's seat in the airplane, and we replace it with essentially a mechanism that flies the airplane just similar to a pilot.
What was the net change in weight?
On the order of essentially the same as, you know, if you had a co-pilot sitting in the airplane. So your average humanoid kind of, you know, would essentially what we replaced with some electronics and mechanical bits to be able to do the unmanned features. So,
any big challenges or unexpected issues that came out of the testing? I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, we were kind of fortunate in that we did a lot of the development, I guess, back in our facility. We have a pretty high fidelity simulator, so we were able to do to deal with a lot of those things in the simulation environment versus actually on flight, so that made it a lot safer. But the most complex pieces of it were the things that are obvious. You know, how do you make an airplane take off and land by itself without operator input? You know, how do you have the airplane handle failures on its own? So those are the things that we spent the most time on thinking about and implementing.
I guess our last question is, what's your next steps?
Good question. If you want to buy one, they're for sale. essentially what we're doing is we're trying to use, this has been a program that the company, I guess, started on its on kind of our own dime. So we've had a couple of launch customers that we've sold systems to. So we're really looking at essentially the productization of this. And it turns out that some of the most interested customers are people who want to use the asset to do, you know, other things such as sense and avoid research, which is a big deal with UAS, or to do, you know, scientific applications where you want to, you know, put a science payload on the airplane and go fly it somewhere like Alaska or whatever, as well as the standard, you know, ISR type thing. So our big next thing is, you know, developing as a product and putting it in the hands of people who want to use it to do good things. So.
All right. Very good. Thanks, Thomas, for speaking to us and our listeners.
No problem.
Hey, we're talking with John Reed from Quanterion. John, thanks for talking to the UAV Digest.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you just mentioned to me a few minutes ago that you're going to be engaging in an interesting project coming up this year.
This year, we'll be working with AFRL and the Air Force. We're getting two UAVs, the Desert Hawk 3 from Lockheed Martin, and we're putting our software and some of our equipment on those planes, and then doing some collision avoidance testing on those planes.
So tell us about the, you know, the testing. What will be the objectives of the test? What are you trying to learn?
We're trying to make sure that the two planes follow an optimum flight path, that they can achieve their objectives, which would be like surveillance areas, would be going to the same waypoint. We'd like to set up, you know, two of the planes going to the exact same waypoint. How do they solve that? We could put in some constraints, like only allowing them to change in elevation, speed, right or left, that kind of thing.
Now, how did you personally get involved in this field? What's your history?
My history is a little strange. I went to St. John Fisher for computer science, and I started working for Quantarian Solutions actually while I was still in college as an intern. And then recently we hired Paul Loschewitz, a colleague of mine. He had been working on this AgentFly software for I think like 20 years. And we just started getting involved with AFRL to do some more interesting projects. And when the contract came up, they said, hey, you want to try and fly some planes, do some software stuff? And I was like, sure. So, you know, I came in and did that.
Was this sort of a dream job for you?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. It'll be very cool when we finally get our planes. I think in the next 2 weeks or so, we should be getting them. And when we do that, I think once I see those things in the air, that'll be very cool. When we can flip the switch and say, you know, just fly.
Now, are you going to be doing that here at the New Air facility?
Yes, we'll be in the Triangle. Do you know that area? If you look at the map of the Griffiths Air Force Base, there's a triangle section. That's the triangle, as they refer to it, and we'll be flying out of there within that triangle.
And so how soon, you said you expect the planes and the aircraft in a few weeks, and how soon after that do you think you'll be up and running?
Probably within a couple weeks after that, possibly a month. We don't want to get too far into winter, you know, with the winters up here, so.
Now, we also mentioned, we were talking before a little bit about some of the simulation software that you have, that you're able to simulate the interactions of manned and unmanned aircraft. You're kind of simulating air traffic control, I guess is the way to describe that.
So another branch of our software is a modeling and simulation section, and we're doing a full national airspace simulation of the planes flying through and the air traffic controllers, their load in four different areas, the cognitive, auditory, psychomotor, and visual load.
And so in effect, it's a way to evaluate different approaches to managing the airspace. So it's sort of a quantifiable way to evaluate different proposals.
Yes, exactly.
Well, very good. So how does it feel to be kind of part of a industry that's really in its infancy and kind of to use a cliche, the sky's the limit, you know?
Yeah, it feels really cool. It's nice to see this kind of thing coming together, this UAV conference, you know, see people starting to be very interested in it. And it's also good to see stuff that's not purely military to kind of change the perception of people in the Mohawk Valley. You know.
Very good. Thanks. And where do our listeners learn more about Quantarian?
If they go to Quantarian.com, which is Quantarion.com.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yep. Thanks.
That was really interesting about how to test in Griffiths. And we actually were privileged to witness some testing, and it was testing in an active airfield.
Right. Absolutely. Yes. They test in this thing called the Triangle at Griffiths. And it's in the middle of this, as you say, this active airport. So they're, and it's all controlled from the same control tower. So they're actually able to demonstrate integration of that fashion just by virtue of the setup there at Griffiths. So,
and we witnessed it happening. They were doing live drone demonstrations in the Triangle, and a C-17 was doing touch and goes out on the main runway at simultaneously using the same airspace. So it was very interesting, although some people tended to pay more attention to the C-17 than the drones that were flying, namely my co-host, because he doesn't really care about the airplane, just the four engines attached to it and propelling it. But it really was a testament to you can integrate UAVs into manned airspace. So I guess with that, Max, let's talk a little feedback and video of the week. The first one I found, which was the firefighting drone from Flight Test. It's a firecopter, which is a custom-made Y6 multirotor equipped with a fire extinguisher for fighting fires from the air. Now, the video is very, very funny, and it involves a lot of automated vehicles, from a radio-controlled airplane to a truck, a radio-controlled truck to this Y-rotor that has a fire extinguisher. So it's very humorous, and I really enjoyed it. What did you think of the other video of the week?
This was the whale encounter from Australia, and the footage is really gorgeous. I think we got this from our listener, Steve, down under. And like I said, the footage is just beautiful. The water is crystal clear. There are these huge whales. There's a guy out on a, what is that, a paddleboard?
Paddleboard, yeah. Right next to it, just sort of just playing with them. It's really phenomenal video.
But you have to be careful when it comes to approaching wildlife. I know there are some treaties. Different countries have different rules about approaching wildlife, sometimes whales, marine mammals in particular. And the New South Wales National Parks and Wildlife Amendment Regulation 2006 actually proscribes how close you can approach to whales and dolphins, marine mammals, I guess, in general. And the distances are, well, I think greater than was the case in this drone. So while I don't think that the whales minded either the guy on the paddleboard or the quadcopter up above filming this, there are regulations and presumably fines involved. So just, you know, be careful before you try this at home.
We like the video, but we don't necessarily condone the behavior.
There you go. That's it.
I guess that'll be a wrap for this week, though I want to give a shout out to our patrons out there. We recorded a lot of content, Max more than me, at our convention, and we will be bringing to you that content over the next couple of weeks in the show. However, as a special benefit to our patrons, I'm going to be sending out a link to a microsite or a specific webpage that has all of our interviews, and we'll continue to have all of the interviews and all of the lectures that we recorded out in one spot, so that you'll have first access to it, and then eventually we'll probably roll it out to everybody else. So to our patron listeners, look for that email probably early next week, where I'll send it out to you guys with the link so you can get firsthand content ahead of everybody else as a kind of thank you from Max and I for your being a patron to the show. And of course, if other people want that extra content, you can always become a patron at the show at patreon.com/theUAVDigest or go to our homepage, theuavdigest.com. So I guess with that, we should wrap this up, Max. We were listening to what episode?
This is episode 115. Find us at theuavdigest.com. Show notes at theuavdigest.com/115.
And of course, on social media, you can find us on Twitter at theuavdigest, on Facebook, which is facebook.com/theuavdigest. And there's multiple ways you can help the show. You can always send us feedback and send us stories, and that's feedback@theuavdigest.com. You can leave a review on Stitcher or iTunes, or you can purchase some swag or merch, as the rest of my podcast friends like to call it, at our Cafe Press store. And of course, you can, like I said previously, become a patron of the show. And there are links to all of those on our webpage, which is theuavdigest.com. Oh, and previews of coming attractions. We've got a lot of good interviews coming down from the convention, and we've got a lot of, I'm very proud of the fact that I've made a link with our Customs and Border Patrol units, and hopefully we'll have them on shortly to talk about their use of drones here in the United States. And it's not spying on people. So I'm looking forward to that. So with that, I'm going to say this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.